Can you hear my kids in the background?
Just about,
Can you hear my wife?
Oh, I can hear your wife. I actually can't hear your kids, but I could hear your wife.
Okay,
you
know. So this is a different...
It makes sense now why you're always calling her loud mouth behind her back, because her mouth seems loud.
I like it when you mention your wife, you tell me afterwards to cut the mention and then...
Cut anything I say, yeah, that's right.
When you say something about my wife, I'll happily leave it in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's so... just, that's, again, you know... Oh, there's a child. I can hear a child there. Or is that an animal?
Meow. So, hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast. We're recording at a diddly different time of day today. It's 5 p.m. on a Friday. Joe was a little bit poorly last night.
Still am.
Still poorly. He's turned up like an absolute pro. But I'm in my kid's bedroom, and there'll be... There might be a little bit of a background vibe.
Yeah, man. Life interrupts, you know. Why would it not interrupt a podcast?
Exactly. This is the show where we chat about the movies or films that we forgot. Invariably, it's the ones that we forgot, because the ones that you forgot, no one's heard of, or they're really big.
Well, they forgot them. They don't know them either.
Yeah. We've forgot the best ones, and we're going to rewatch the best ones. All the worst ones. Joining me, as ever, he's a leaky bucket brain, and he's a leaky nosed boy nose brain as well. It's Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello. You all right?
Yeah, I'm really up, man, and you're really down. This is going to be a great episode.
Well, no, I think it will be on account of the fact that we're recording it in a diddly different way.
Oh, mate, even if you're on 40%, that's 100% for anyone else.
All that's left is to hear when you say words like diddly by accident and then throw them back at you. That's all I've got.
I mean, it tickles my onions.
Good.
Before we kick off into the episode, I've got a lovely little bit of Letterboxd chat, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
I've obviously watched today's film, and listener Johnny, he commented on my review of today's film, and he said, "That's super plum worthy." And then he said, "Is it plum, P-L-U-M, or plum, P-L-U-M-B? Sorry, I'm an unsophisticated American." Now, oh, that sent me down a lovely little spiral of reminiscence, because I vaguely remember saying it very early doors,
yep.
"That's plum," and then you really... seized on it and made it your own.
Uh-huh.
For me, do you know what it is or what it's from?
The word that you used or the word that we now use?
Well, the original usage of the word, when I said, "Oh, that's plum," did you know what I meant?
I understood your meaning of it, yeah.
Oh, okay. How would you spell that meaning?
Well, I would spell it with no B. I would spell it P-L-U-M. But I understand why an emailer might suggest that there could be a B involved.
That was how it was always spelt in my mind. And for me, it evokes my childhood playing cricket. You know, when you'd get someone out LBW, you'd say, "That's plum," as in that ball's going to go straight onto the wicket.
Yes.
But that word, plum, as you understand it and I understand it, that is actually spelt P-L-U-M-B.
With a B?
With a B. Plum means exact or straight up.
Oh, yes. I'm looking now. There's a plum bob. A plum bob, plum bob level or plummet, is a weight, usually with a pointed tip on the bottom, suspended from a string and used as a vertical direction, as a reference line or a plumb line.
Plumb line. There you go.
It's a precursor to the spirit level. Hey, do you know, on pronunciations, after last week's episode, I was playing a game of Civilization 6. Do you know what that is?
No.
No. It's sort of like a map strategy game where you can play against real people or the computer, and you lead a civilization from the ancient times all the way through to the modern era. And you build little different cities and stuff, and you try to kind of take over the map, and, you know, it's good fun. But one of the functions of this game is that you can name your cities if you so choose. Sometimes I do it for fun, sometimes I don't do it for fun. You know, it's all about fun. But this particular session I did, and I thought, something I haven't done before. Every time I get a new city, I will name the city but it will be with the first actor I think of, regardless of whether that's appropriate or I like the actor, or it's just whoever comes into my head first that is an actor, I'll put them down. And then, oh, I've forgotten his fucking name. What's his name? The guy from last week.
What film did we do last week? We did,
The German film.
Ulrich Möhe.
Oh, yeah.
Möhe.
And then one of my first city on a new continent, I named Ulrich Möhe, yeah? After the lead, the protagonist in The Lives of Others. And that city turned out to be my most important resource city for developing spies. It was just a complete coincidence. But I thought, before I started talking, that was a worthy thing to mention. And now I've realised that it isn't.
No, you're like one of those people who says, you know, the other day I was thinking of Mother, and who should call? My phone started calling and ringing. Who should it be but Mother? What are the chances? Oh, the other day I was thinking of that song by Michael Jackson, and what should come on the radio? That song by Michael Jackson, that really popular song that's on all the time. What are the chances? The other day I was thinking about Father, and then Father, he called me, even though he was dead in the ground. He called me. What are the chances? That's what you're like.
Those chances are pretty low. They're pretty low. But I always believe, that's why I play the lottery, you know, because I'm hoping one day I just get to hear his voice one more time.
You what? I don't get it.
That he might call. That this has all been this has all been a horrible dream. Sometimes I think that.
Oh, because the lottery, yeah. You'd win the lottery and then you go, oh, right, I've been asleep this whole time.
Well, just the lottery was just about the likelihood of something happening, you know? Like the likelihood of me winning the lottery, or the likelihood of me ever seeing my father again.
Yeah, I still can't unpick that.
Right.
It's depressing. Yeah. And then you're ill. Yeah. So it fits.
What I mean is, I would like to win the lottery.
Yeah. You know? And you'd like daddy to not be dead.
I'd like my father to be alive.
Right.
But both of those things are unlikely to happen, you know. But right. Because I live in hope.
Right.
I hope to win the lottery. That's why I'm playing.
Yeah.
I don't play. And I like to hope that even though I'm an atheist,
yeah,
when I'm dead. You ever see those videos on TikTok? I know you're off TikTok. You ever see those videos on Instagram where there's the lovely dog bounding towards you through a field and the tagline is just, this guy is the first thing you see when you get to heaven or whatever, after you die. It's like someone's been waiting for you. It's your dog and he's bounding towards you. I always think, what if that was my father bounding towards me, you know, through a meadow, like a dog?
In his Notting Hill shirt and without a bag.
He wouldn't have a bag. No one has a bag in heaven, you know?
How does he differentiate himself up in heaven then? Because he didn't have a bag in life. And then if he's up in heaven, he's thinking, oh, who am I up here? I've not got a bag. No one's got a bag. is heaven just a Notting Hill-esque montage whereby you walk through the seasons without a bag?
That's interesting, isn't it? Maybe he's got a bag now. I don't know how I'll cope if he's got a bag.
You'll go, you've changed, man.
You've changed.
Are you even... When you meet the people who have died in heaven...
Yeah. Who've dead.
Who've dead.
Yeah.
Diddly dead. Surely they've changed, right? Because they've experienced heaven for so long. And then you meet them and they would be fundamentally different. Would they be the people that you knew?
They'd be blissed out to the max. That's true, they would be different, wouldn't they?
Has anyone ever asked that question? Very incisive question. It only just occurred to me.
I felt like it was asked by David Hume.
Oh, fuck off.
No, I don't know. I'm sure it was.
I think it was... You don't even know who David Hume is.
I know who David Hume is. Come on. I think it was asked by Aristotle. No one wants to say Aristotle in that situation. What am I going to say? I think it was asked by David Starkey, you know.
That's good, because you went... You're so smart. You're smart enough not to know not to say Aristotle.
Sure.
which is why I love
you. Just
not
smart enough to know everything about David Hume.
Yeah.
Just have a look at David Hume. Yeah, David Hume, Scottish philosopher and historian. I know about Hume. He's something about a watch. I don't know. Something about how a watch proved that there was a god, you know? Sounds like a fucking idiot to me.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Well, you know, talking of heaven, that really leads us straight into the movie that we're talking about. Because death plays a huge part in the key character's journey.
Oh, I thought you meant because they were in the heavens.
I was going to do that too, both.
That's good. I like that.
And in the heavens. We're talking about this very day, 2013's Alfonso Cuarón directed Gravity.
Yeah.
Starring Sandy B, George Clooney, and then no one else of any note who pops up.
Well, you know, Ed Harris, the voice of Ed Harris.
Oh, is it the voice of Ed Harris?
Ed Harris plays the voice of Mission Control at the beginning, yeah. Until things start to go wrong and you don't speak to them again.
Mission Control in the dark. Let's get to the letterbox. Oh, it's a wonderfully brief 91 minutes.
That is good.
Yeah, it's good, but you also it feels more like 120.
Really?
it doesn't fly by.
Oh, it flew by for me and the wife.
Oh, good. Oh, okay, we'll get onto that. We'll get onto flybys. 91 minutes.
That's what she said anyway.
Hey, you're going to tell me to cut that in the edit, aren't you? You fucking piece of shit. Right, let's go to the Gravity letterboxed.
Yep.
Don't let go. Dr. Ryan Stone, played by Sandra Bullock, a brilliant medical engineer on her first shuttle mission with veteran astronaut Matt Kowalski, George Clooney, in command of his last flight before retiring. Oh, fucking hell, that's one sentence.
Wait, did you call her a medical engineer?
Yeah, the letterbox is giving far more information than is revealed clearly in the film. You do get a sense...
I don't think she's a medical engineer.
She's more about hospitals than she is space.
Right.
Yeah, you might miss that. When I watched this film, the dialogue was... I was listening with my AirPods. I'm a bit deaf in my right ear.
Yeah.
But I had the dialogue was so low in the mix.
Yes.
I cranked it right up and I was still like, is this deliberate?
At the very beginning, because the film starts with huge music and caught us by surprise. So I turned it down a little. And then there's a slow Alfonso Cuarón style scene at the opening where this spaceship is coming slowly into view. The whole thing takes about 3 or 4 minutes. And there's background audio, there's chitter-chatter, but you can't make it out. So you think, okay, this is intentional. And it increases slowly over time to the extent where I'm going, well, now I have to turn the volume up. Is this a me problem now? Is this a them problem? Am I supposed to know? Am I not? I didn't like that, you know? I don't like that.
No, I cranked it up and you can hear it's deliberately, we're not talking about what we're doing, chat.
Yeah.
It's all very casual.
Did you hear what happened to the man in Tallahassee?
Exactly. Although I do think it invented that space trope. You know, to give Gravity its due, I think it invented that. Because now it's very much a trope. If you've got someone in space...
Mate, no chance.
You are.
That's not getting past me. That is not... It's Space Cowboys, man. Have you seen Space Cowboys?
Oh,
this whole thing is Space Cowboys. That's all they do is old American dudes in space, and they're going, do you remember I had that milkshake in Jacksonville? That's it. That's the whole movie. And then they're like trying to express their physical dominance over younger, clearly dominant males, you know? But it's Clint, so what are you going
to
do?
We have to do Space Cowboys.
I would absolutely love to do Space Cowboys. I thought you hadn't seen it.
I don't, but so we have to do a special of Space Cowboys.
I think we really should. We really should, because...
Because you've mentioned it so many times.
I think it might be genre defining.
And I'm going to have to put my hands up. I thought... Gravity invented the casual chat and space thing, and you're
It was Space Cowboys with Clint, with Tommy, with Donald Sutherland, with that other guy who I still don't know who he is.
Yeah,
well, I understand that he's famous. The fourth musketeer. Who knows? A D'Artagnan of
space. It's James Garner. I don't worry. It's James Garner. So anyway, okay. this first sentence isn't... This sentence doesn't have a payoff.
Oh, yeah, the letterbox.
Dr. Ryan Stone, a brilliant medical engineer on her first shuttle mission with veteran astronaut Matt Kowalski in command of his last flight before retiring. That's the sentence, apparently.
Yep.
Stone, played by Bullock. Kowalski, Clooney.
Uh-huh.
But on a seemingly routine spacewalk, disaster strikes. The shuttle is destroyed, leaving Stone and Kowalski completely alone, tethered to nothing but each other, and spiralling out into the blackness of space. The deafening silence tells them they have lost any link to Earth and any chance for rescue. As fear turns to panic, every gulp of air eats away at what little oxygen is left. But the only way home may be to go further out into the terrifying expanse of space. I mean, that's a very long letterbox for what is a very, very simple film.
Yeah.
You like this. What should we chat about first? You liking it?
Yeah, I think so. I did like it. Do you know, I didn't like it the first time I watched it, which was in the cinema. The only time I'd seen it before this podcast. I remember thinking, hey, that was a thrill ride, you know? Cool. But whatever, it's sort of, I'm going to forget it. And I did forget it. This time I was much more impacted by the emotional crux of the story. I think that perhaps is something that you and I disagree on a little bit. So I wonder if that's the place to start.
Let's dig in.
I'm going to go right to the meat. Yeah.
Yeah, the meat is
that she's got a dead kid in the past.
She's been dead kidded.
And I think when I watched this in, when was it, 2013 or something? Yeah, 2013 in the cinema. I was 23 years old. I was jaded. I didn't know what it was to have a dead kid. I don't now, but I'm more sympathetic.
I'd love it if you'd left a slightly longer pause there.
And I think also I thought, oh, dead kid trope. You can't move. You can't move for dead kids in Hollywood. You know, they're just everywhere. These movies, these TV series, sometimes it's used to brilliant effect. Other times I think, like, come on, why does everyone have to have a dead kid? It feels like at the time I felt that it was a cheat code to instantly getting an audience on side. And I think I shelved this film in my leaky memory bank in the kind of, it was fine, but like I'm putting it in the box marked like there was no need to have that dead kid. Whereas this time, I'm so into the dead kid, I believe it. And I saw the thing that moved me the most watching the film was seeing, Sandra Bullock over 90 minutes, like this one, basically one long scene of the horrible tribulations of her trying to save herself. I saw it as a brilliant visual metaphor for the horror of the grief that the character was experiencing. And I totally bought into it. So that really helped my enjoyment of the film.
Yeah, it is definitely a Hollywood trope, but I would say more than that, It's a genre trope. You certainly see it loads in horror films.
Do you? In horrors?
There'll be someone who's dead, and the character, the final girl, or whoever it is mourning something, they can't get over something, and then the terrifying experience that they go through will be all about catharsis for them to kind of go, oh, hang on a sec, there are worse things than having a dead kid. I can move on now.
Yeah.
And this is a horror movie in space, in that, you know, space is the stalking villain, and everything's going to go wrong.
The ghost is all around you.
Oh, mate, you really are a lyricist. Every time you think you're safe, space is going to pop up again and blow some rivets out of a thing, and you'll be like, oh God, I've got to crack on again.
Nobody can hear you scream. in space.
Nobody can hear you snore watching Gravity.
Yeah, in space. Exactly.
In space.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's lovely that you came around to that, because that it is, I think, the only thing that does the journey a disservice is the crummy dialogue.
Sure.
And yeah. Sandra Bullock's slightly over-egged performance.
No, no. I won't. Yeah. No, no, no.
Can we please? Come on. She really... She does this whole bit where she says, "Oh, and when you get to heaven, if you see a little scruffy girl, she hasn't got her shoelaces tied,
sure.
Will you?
That's the script. That's the dialogue.
Will you
about.
Say hello to her? She's a little scruffy kid. She's talking about heaven. She's imagining her kid in heaven as if the kid hasn't changed or grown up.
Right.
She's not asked David Hume. She hasn't thought about."
Do kids grow up in heaven?
Oh, there we go. That's
Do
a
they
Hollywood,
stop
that's
growing?
A Disney picture waiting to be made.
What age is the perfect age? Do they get to like 27 and then that's it? That's the age they are in heaven
No,
forever?
You get fixed. You're fixed. The kid's fixed as...
They're fixed at the age, but like mentally, surely they can't be because they're infinite up there, aren't they? In heaven, as far as I understand.
And also, so then that means the kid, when she does meet the kid, it won't be the kid anymore.
Well, now it's like we're talking about Interstellar, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I wish we were talking about Interstellar instead of Gravity.
Oh, much prefer
no.
Gravity.
So anyway, okay, you're right. So I think Sandy B has been served up some duff dialogue. Am
Murph!
I wrong?
Oh, Murph! Up behind the bookcase, Murph! Murph!
Are you ragging on Interstellar?
Yeah, fuck that shit, man. Fuck that shit.
All right, listen. Pack it, park it.
Pack it. Park
fuck
it.
Off. Yep. Okay. You're right, though. I am slagging off a movie you just said you liked. I think you're right. I've just slagged off Sandy B. I think she's more like... So she's been served up some duff dialogue.
Yeah, she has. I think she does a terrific job in that scene. It's a really good scene. I think, you know, the only thing that stands against it is I remember that the scene you're talking about when she's, you know, she's talking to by this point departed George Clooney, and she's saying, "When you get up there and see my daughter, will you pass on that I love her?" Whatever. That's just after she's made a decision to live. You know, that's after the emotional apex of the film, where before in the scene leading up to that, she was not just considering, was taking steps towards ending her life and giving up on her hope of getting home. And that scene or shots from that scene were used widely in awards shows and award show videos that year. So I think that also was one of the things that kind of turned me off from it on the first viewing, was because I felt that what I can see now as the lovely, quite subtle, quite small emotional apex of the film was kind of plastered all over everything to show what a great actress Sandra Bullock is, Sandy B. I happen to agree with that, but I don't love the inauthenticity of the awards show element. But that scene's, I think the scene is great. I think she does a really, really good job to deliver an emotional and moving performance with a script that does leave a lot to be desired. It really does.
Do you not think that moment is, and I think you've got to have seen Gravity to enjoy this episode or listen to it, I think. Am I right? I think so. Okay, so go back.
Well, just quickly, yeah. If you haven't seen it, if you want to watch it, stop listening to this bit now. Skip forwards 30 seconds. If you have seen it, or if you just want to know what happens, they're in space. They're fixing something. Then there's a fucking shrapnel disaster, and everything's gone. And she has to like go between two different spaceships to try to get back down. And there's no way of doing it. And every time she does anything, it's hopeless. And there's a horrible thing that happens, and it's inevitable that she's going to die. And you find out also that she had a kid die 4 years ago. So she's sad. And she doesn't really want to survive either. And that's the journey. 90 minutes of horrible things going wrong, and eventually her getting back down to Earth and landing on a beach and standing up and lives to fight another day. Big Sandy B, you know? That's the movie.
That is the movie. Do you think, though, that big emotional moment, do you think that film is served well by the re-entrance of George Clooney?
No. But yeah. I do, yeah, I mean, and the bit that Adam is referring to here, Sandra
the same
Bullock,
bit, we're all in the same bit.
This is all the same bit, but essentially at the bottom of the ravine of Sandra Bullock's motivation for living, the end of second act, she's turning off, you know, she's depressurizing the tiny spaceship she's in. She's allowing space to take her. And she obviously passes out. And hey, back comes George Clooney, who's 100% dead. He's got in the spaceship. They're chatting. He's giving her a little motivation. He's letting her know the technical thing to do. He's obviously her subconscious speaking to herself. She wakes up. He's not there.
Oh, is he, Joe? Thanks. I love it.
I'm letting the audience know. Yeah. She wakes up. She turns back on. What he comes to represent the part of her which wants to live. You know, I don't know how else you do that in the
you do
scene.
It with the kid, or you do it with
what the kid shows up.
Why not?
You can't.
I don't know.
No. You got to respect the sanctity and the purity of the kid. No, you leave the kid out of it.
No, because the film, if it's her subconscious, it's her kid. The film being the film that it is, the film that you're watching. Unfortunately, you believe in that moment that it could be the kind of Hollywood bullshit that would bring George Clooney back to life.
Yeah. I think that's fortunate, otherwise it's stupid.
At that moment, you think, hang on, what? Are they doing this? Because I've seen films that do that. Yeah. And obviously, it, you know, minutes later it reveals it doesn't. But it can't turn back time on my emotions,
really?
Of my engagement. And it can't say, oh, no, hang on a sec, don't worry. Because I've already thought this is bullshit.
That sounds like a you problem, man.
You go to the pub,
you meet a friend for the first time, you misjudge them and think they said something wrong. Turns out they didn't say that, but you go, oh, it's too late because I thought you did, so now I think this about you. And it's too late to change that. That does sound like me. That's exactly what you're saying. That's a you problem.
That's an everyone problem. That's a cinematic story problem that the film disengages the viewer at that point, because the context within which gravity exists, mm-hmm. it's the kind of movie where they would do that for real and you would call bullshit on it. The fact that it isn't doesn't get it out of that problem. It's let the air out of the film. It made me think the whole notion of film criticism is absolutely pointless, because if you don't like a film, it just means you've watched it at the wrong time. Hey, fuck all that, Joe. Let's go back and let's talk Cuarón director.
Alfonso.
The very same. Because you love Children of Men.
Yes.
He's got a pretty stacked, decent filmography, although he's started to, I think, disappear up his own bottom of late. He's done, you know, for you, he's done a Potter, he's done Children of Men.
He did the best Potter. I mean, it's not the one that I think is the best, but it's the one that people consider the best, Azkaban. But then what my best isn't really about filmmaking. It's more about tone and personal equations. Equations? Yeah, personal equations.
You don't have to caveat that. He hasn't actually made that many films.
He's made a number of films. I mean, most of the films he made were all films that people liked, you know, I guess.
Well, people love Children of Men. I think that is considered, yeah. I think he's got one massive film that is unequivocally part of the canon.
It's my favourite film.
Right? And everything else, E2 Mamma Tambien is very well regarded.
Sure. But always comes up on all the lists, as does Paris Je T'aime.
Yeah, but that's a series of shorts, so it doesn't count.
Fine.
Roma.
Yeah.
No one's going to talk about that movie ever again.
But it did win something, didn't it?
Can't recall. Honestly, no one's talking about the movie. It's a Netflix movie. It doesn't count.
I didn't watch it.
Yeah, nor did I. I started watching it and then got bored.
Right.
Harry Potter. Chat to me about, it's not your favourite, it doesn't have to be your favourite. You know Potter.
I know Potter. Do you know what he does very well? And I think for why he's really well suited, this is Quaron, well suited to the Prisoner of Azkaban specifically, is because for people who don't know the books or haven't read them, haven't seen the film, there's the ending of this book and film is it all happens and then it happens again. There's a time turning element here. There's a time traveling element involved. It's the only Harry Potter book where that is that's the case.
How come they don't use the time turner later on in the other books, Joe?
Why don't the hobbits fly on the eagles to drop a ring into Mount Doom? These questions can only be answered by time, and they're also dumb, and I hate them. You know,
no, the eagles. You've answered the eagles. I don't mind the eagles. I'm fully bought in. But the time turner, when you read the next book,
sure, yeah.
Someone says to Hermione, like, oh, Mrs. McGonagall, Professor McGonagall took my time turner back. It's like, why?
That's right. So that it can't be used in the plot. Why is Hermione doing a Scottish accent?
Because she's saying, this is what Professor McGonagall said to me in this accent. She said, Hermione, you're not allowed to use the time turner anymore because I introduced it as a plot device in the last book. And now if you use it in this one, it makes it all redundant. Anyway, let's smash the time turner. I wish it never mentioned it.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And the good thing about Harry Potter is it's magic, you see. So it's magic, you know?
It's magic. And sometimes magic doesn't work. Sometimes it only applies for a certain amount of time.
Well, yeah, you don't have to answer. It's like, how did you... You said Alohomora and the door open. What's the mechanisms of that? It's magic. Fuck off. You know, that's the answer. Why can you do something? Why can't you? Because magic. I don't have to explain. And that's why, you know, I'm fully sort of why would the big dog with three heads, why would it be as simple as playing music? Is there some kind of salivation involved? Who's the guy who made the dog salivate? You know, not in Harry Potter, in the experiment. Pavlov. Is this Pavlov's three-headed dog? You know, how did he get it to go to sleep? Magic. These are the kind of answers you can expect from,
you know, Scabbers.
J.K. Rowling. Scabbers, yeah.
The mouse, the rat.
He's a rat.
Yeah. Because I imagined that Ron had a rat.
Yes.
And then Peter Pettigrew became Scabbers and then just kind of swapped in and said, hello, I'm your new rat. He was the rat the whole time. But all rats look alike. But that would make more sense if he interceded as he kills the other rat and is like, hello, I'm Scabbers, effectively.
He becomes a cuckoo for the pet rat.
Exactly.
He acts as a cuckoo. I don't think that makes more sense. I'm not sure why you think that.
Well, it's quite a role to take on, just being a rat. Yeah. What's so marvellous about Ursula Le Guin in her Earthsea novels, which... Yeah. Transcend all Potter nonsense, but are all about wizards and mages and whatnot. She really talks about what it means to be a wizard and to become an animal.
Yeah.
And the thing in those books is if you become an animal for too long, you forget who you were. You forget your humanity and you stay as that creature. She introduces a rule as to why you wouldn't just go in and out of being an animal. And it's thematically beautiful and profound, but it's also, it also means something. And it stops characters just going, oh, I'm a horse, or I'm a rat, or I'm a cat. You know, if Rowling had anything about her, she would have been able to do something likewise with the time turner. But
no,
she couldn't be bothered. She just said Mrs. McGonagall has fucking taken the thing back.
Now, that's a fair criticism. And I would say two things, okay?
Two. Your lord, you do know you're lord of two.
Yeah,
right?
I'm the lord of two. And two things I will say, okay? The first of those two things is, and don't interrupt me, J.K. Rowling started this Harry Potter series as books for children, and they evolved into something else over time. So when you get to the middle, which would be around Azkaban and the Triwizard Tournament, the one afterwards, is that what it's called? Oh, the Goblet of Fire, that's what it's called. Things start to change and things stop making as much sense. The time turner, for example, that's probably an idea that she had when she still thought that this was going to be for 10-year-old children. Who needs to explain the the machinations and the mechanics of a magic system to 10-year-olds. You don't. They're 10. They're stupid. They don't understand anything. So, you know, you can just say, this is what it is. That's gone now. And a bit like a dog, if the cheese is there, they want the cheese. If the cheese isn't there, they are not thinking, you know, maybe they're thinking about cheese. We can't know what's happening in a dog's head. So that's the first thing. The second thing, it was really good, the second thing. I spent ages on the first thing.
Ages. Oh, yeah. Do you know what? For the first time in your life, you honestly hadn't spent ages on something. You were really beautifully, perfectly concise about point one, and you hadn't gone into a fucking cul-de-sac of something else.
I've recalled it now. Yeah. The second thing is that Harry Potter,
yeah,
it's not real fantasy. It isn't. Right, so like it doesn't follow the rules of normal fantasy. Ursula Le Guin, for example, you used her. Robert Jordan, I think, is a great example. Someone like Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings. These people go to absolute lengths to describe the mechanics of their magic systems, and the magic system amongst fantasy fans of the fantasy books, the fantasy reading community. Whether the magic system is of interest or not, or is original or not, or is kind of in some, you know, is more traditional, is a real thing that these people talk about, and it's a real selling point for these sorts of books. J.K. Rowling doesn't do that at all. It's like this is why the Harry Potter books, they're really not fantasy. They're just children's stories, and then later they're like children's stories if they were written for adults, you know? And so that's why I would say that there are those some specific differences there. But you're right to point to the time turner, because it's one of those things that sits kind of awkwardly between when these were for 7-8-year-old children and when the books became for older teenagers, as they do towards the end.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
Okay, Quaron. Everyone pinpoints number three, Azkaban, as having a particular flavour where the other ones don't. And then maybe it's because latterly David Yates directs them all.
Yeah.
And so he's the outlier, auteur of the bunch.
Sure, sure. I think so. I mean, and I think it's because of the ending. It does include the time turner. The story happens, and then the story happens again. And it's a very interesting, it's a very tried and tested format for films, for cinema. It's not something that is, you know, it's not particularly original. But what we get to see with, what we get to see with Azkaban is Harry and Hermione witnessing everything twice, watching themselves at the kind of, you know, the pinnacle of the moment that the film is focusing on, watching themselves and how they acted in these very long-winded scenes where two or three things are happening all at the same time, and where they're, you know, the camera does cut, but the film does a very good job of making you feel like everything's happening in one long flowing scene, which is what we see so often in these Alfonso Cuarón movies. And the thing about Azkaban that really, really makes it special amongst the Harry Potter films is that the emotional payoff, it pays out. It doesn't always happen in the other films. One of the criticisms I have of those movies generally is the end of the Harry Potter story, right at the very end of the books and in the final film. There's a huge emotional payout in the books, I think, which they found it really hard to convey in the films. It's quite good. It gets me because I'm super into the story, and you know, I'm a willing passenger. But generally speaking, I don't think it's really achieved in the way that a filmmaker might sit back and say that's ideal. Whereas in The Prisoner of Azkaban, watching young Harry walk up to a place where he's expecting to see who he believes is his dead father saving him from something. And then he, you know, there's a moment of realization where he realizes, oh, it was me that I saw, with the time turner. He steps forward, he becomes his father, he saves himself. The emotional payoff of the film after 20 minutes or so of Alfonso Cuarón's kind of flowing events and flowing cinematography, it really works, and it doesn't in many of the other movies. So I think he did a great job.
Children of Men. You mentioned it before.
Yeah.
Your favourite film. I rewatched that recently. I had not seen that since I saw it in the cinema.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
No, I can't believe that. I mean, I can because it's you, but, you know, go on. Tell me what you thought.
Oh, it's great.
It might be worth a very brief what the film is for anyone who hasn't seen it.
You did this really well last time. I just assume everyone knows what films are.
Right.
So Children of Men came out in 2006. 109 mins. This kind of film now would be 130.
Yeah, sure.
It's a film set in futuristic dystopian London.
Yeah, I'd call it near future, but yeah.
Yeah, Clive Owen plays a grumpy old git. There's been no babies for like 20 years.
Yep, 18.
18. Grumpy old git, Clive Owen. Formerly a revolutionary type, now looking out only for himself, mm-hmm. gets pulled into the underground of revolution via someone who appears to be pregnant, and he's got to help them. And you get to race through this near future.
Yeah.
Well, that's the flick, right?
And he's in every scene.
Clive Owen. We had a big Clive Owen chat around King Arthur.
Yeah.
He is superb in this. He's great
better
in
than
this.
Ever, for sure.
Better than ever. He's good in Closer. I don't really think films know what to do with him.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a bag.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't have a bag.
Clive Owen is a classic man without a bag, but he's got a trench coat.
There's a moment in when they're all in the car in the woods, and this is how hard I'd forgot this movie. I forgot what happened in the car, in the woods. You know what happens.
With the ping pong ball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is where we're going to start. I think we're going to start to compare, contrast Children of Men to Gravity, because there is so, like in both of those films, there is phenomenal craft and filmmaking. Oneers. One big long one takes.
Yeah.
AKA oneers.
He does not like to cut, does he? He likes to turn the camera as though you were, you know, I'm thinking in that car scene that the shot goes between the person in the passenger seat next to the driver and then the person sat in the back behind the passenger seat, and the camera just kind of tilts like a head backwards and forwards between those two characters, you know?
And I guess it creates a sense of immediacy and it puts you right in the story. I think sometimes it can feel quite hacky and try hard, but having seen, like rewatching Children of Men and Gravity, it never really feels like, it never feels hacky or try hard. When it was in Iratu, in The Revenant, mm-hmm. the whole opening sequence felt like hacky and try hard.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And you said to me via WhatsApp, you said, characters are very similar in Children of Men and Gravity. They both have dead kids.
Yeah.
And that hadn't even occurred to me when I rewatched Gravity.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So Cuarón, he likes to paint in these big, broad, emotional brushstrokes.
If he could have given Harry and Hermione a dead kid, he would have done it. But the story was already written in a book. And yeah, there's a dead dad. It's not quite the same, but it is sort of the same.
He's happy to, he's like, oh, I'll take that. And I'm going to pretend it's a dead kid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then I'm going to use the strength of the dead dad. But it was just my strength all along. I'm alive. The same thing happens with Sandy B. Same thing happens with Clive Owen, you know. I think these are very similar films. I think if you watched two of them not knowing they were the same director, you would say that one was probably derivative of the other, or that the person who made the second one had seen the first, because there are many similarities, not just the way that it looks and those long flowing scenes and the way that it feels as you watch it, but also the type of characters that we're watching, the amount of backstory that the writer directors want the characters to reveal, the way in which they reveal that stuff. It works for me way better in Children of Men than it does in Gravity, but I think the same sort of tools are used. So, for example, you know, we learn more about Sandra Bullock through this kind of slightly hacky kind of, you know, chit-chat. And the means by which Quaron extracts this information from all this exposition, essentially from Sandra Bullock in Gravity, is by having George Clooney get her to talk to calm her down, because she has a certain amount of oxygen left in her suit. It's going to run out. She's going to die. So he's trying to calm her down. He's trying to take her mind off the situation. And he's asking her questions that, you know, a paramedic, for example, might ask in a difficult medical situation.
I like that scene. That worked. That works. Nice.
Right. That's the kind of thing that happens in Children of Men. It's the kind of way that the information is released, is kind of drip-fed to you as an audience in Children of Men. The difference is Children of Men is, for my money, the best film ever made.
It's also got other screenwriters on it.
Yeah.
And the problem when you've got a director who holds himself in very high regard and thinks they're the best thing since sliced bread, who insists on writing their own screenplays with their sons and thinks they're better than everyone else. you know, you can have all the craft in the world, but if you think if you've got a tin ear for dialogue, you've got a tin ear for dialogue.
Right, the dialogue is not good. It's not good in Gravity.
It's because of that, and I'm happy to say it. No, he's never going to hear. No one gives a fuck what I think.
Sure.
But there's a history of directors disappearing in their own arms.
You know.
Yeah, I'm sat in my child's bedroom. I'm going nowhere.
Yeah.
I've got a tin ear for life.
That's right.
I'm fucked.
Yeah. You couldn't even hear the dialogue in this film on account of you being deaf and sat in your child's bedroom. But it is bad dialogue, I agree.
Even,
I don't like it.
You know, I'll admit sometimes Sir Christopher Nolan, who's always written or co-written his screenplays, sometimes doesn't have a great ear for dialogue.
Sure.
But not as a rule.
No.
Whereas I think Quaron, as a rule, does.
As a rule. Well, one other thing I would say, another similarity, is that the backdrops to these films are pretty different. That, I mean, they're both kind of science-y, if we're saying space is... I mean, obviously Gravity is not a sci-fi film, but it kind of is. It's a space movie, I guess. But the backdrops are very different in both of these. But essentially the story is the same. We're watching one slightly jaded central character go through a transformation over a short period of time to rediscover something about themselves that was there before, but that for some reason, and, you know, similar reasons in these films, dead child, aka, has been blocked from view. So the character that you meet at the beginning becomes, you know, grows into something that they had before, reveals their potential, and in doing so either saves themselves, as in the case of Sandy B., or save somebody else, as in the case of Clive Owen. So the films are basically identical. The difference is, as you rightly point out, there's extra screenwriters on one of them, and there's also an absolutely fucking phenomenal supporting cast in Children of Men. Julianne Moore, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Michael Caine, who all play characters that are vital to the story. The performances are brilliant. Like, they have really moving, independent subplots and motivations. And unfortunately, whilst George Clooney's really fun in Gravity, he's really just a kind of plot device character. Like, I don't really care about his story. I don't care that he's retiring. I don't care that, you know, he seems to be really calm in this situation, or that he lets himself drift off into space, or that he loves to look at the sunset. Like, I'm not really interested in that at all. So I think there are many similarities, and at the same time, like, some huge missing elements that could have made Gravity something more than what it is.
You know who was originally supposed to play these parts?
I do not. I'd love to know, though.
Should we do a little game? Do you want to have two guesses?
Yeah, all right, fine.
So you've got to think back to 2013. These are two huge stars.
Who were originally
cast in mind,
okay,
for the Sandy B and the George Clooney roles.
2013. And are they similar ages to these people?
Yeah, George Clooney, similar age. Sandy B, I'll tip my hat and say a bit older.
A bit older. I mean, it's not Brad Pitt, is it?
It's not Brad Pitt, no.
Okay. Who's the guy?
The guy is Robert Downey Jr.
No.
And
that probably would have been quite good. I could see him in that role.
Yeah, but they couldn't do it because it turns out Downey Jr., he's such a little stickler for being able to improv and make up his own dialogue.
Ah.
it wouldn't work. We probably don't have time to get into the technical achievement of the of Gravity.
No.
But how they made this film, it broadly stands up and it looks like they've actually shot it. It's basically 80% CGI.
Yeah. I mean, it's very good looking.
It's very good looking. There's a couple of moments with Sandra Bullock at one point where you're like, oh, I can sort of tell that your body's not real. But it, in comparison to something like Avatar, which is all blue aliens, where there's a disconnect where you know it's not real, to have human bodies interacting with, you know, real life spaceships and you completely buy it, we're nearly 10 years later. It does mostly stand up. But anyway, they couldn't, the amount of planning it took for the shots and the lighting and all that kind of shit.
They had to be efficient.
Yeah, and Downey Jr. was just, he wants to go, I want to say this. It's like, no, please just say the fucking lines.
We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this, please.
So it's gone, Sandy B, older.
Older than Sandy
not
B?
A bit older, maybe. Not, let's say the same-ish. Because she's quite old now. She's old then.
That's interesting, because the only name that's coming to mind, it just came up when you were talking about Robert Downey Jr. I thought I would take a Marvel connection. I was going to say Scarlett Johansson, but she's obviously not
too
older
young.
Than...
Too
yeah,
young.
She's far too young. Okay, so someone who's a little bit older. I mean, it's not Julianne Moore, is it?
No, I'm talking someone who is just a superstar.
Julia Roberts?
No, not Julia Roberts.
A superstar.
She's in the trailer, similar trailer for Notting Hill in the past.
Yeah.
The trades would have loved that.
Reese Witherspoon?
No, she's not. No.
Jennifer Aniston?
Mate. No, mate, come on. You're talking about B-list nobodies at the moment.
How dare you?
They are, in comparison.
Yeah, I guess so. So in comparison to this person, Jennifer Aniston is a B-list nobody.
Aniston's not cinema, mate. She's TV.
Hey, I really liked TV names. Horrible Bosses. And Horrible Bosses 2. And Cake.
Yeah, as I say, she's cake. A B-lister.
Right, you think she's a B-lister.
She's a B-lister. She's nothing in cinema, mate. She's TV. She's TV. Just let it lie.
Okay, maybe I'll let it lie.
You might not like this actress. But
no,
she's...
I've got it. I'm getting there now. Is
you're
it,
close with Brad.
Is it? Who was I close with?
If you think Brad Pitt, you'll get it.
Is it Lara Croft? Is it Angelina Jolie?
It is.
It was. They were originally going to cast Angelina Jolie in this.
And Downey Jr. Yeah.
I mean, I don't see that working.
No, she hasn't got the range.
I don't think, with the greatest of respect,
no,
she's
mate,
no
just
Sandy
say it.
B.
I mean, I could also, I'd much rather anyone else other than Sandra Bullock play this role.
Well, that's just
I'd love to see Julianne
offensive.
Moore play it.
Listen, Juliet, but the thing is about Julianne Moore is that we all know she can fucking do it. You know, Julianne Moore's one of the greats, right? One of the best actors of all time, Julianne Moore.
Absolutely.
We all know she can do it. I'm not surprised by watching her do it, okay? Oh, someone's ringing the phone in the child's room. Hello?
Someone's buzzing. Tell me, so here we go. Okay, why do you want to be surprised by someone doing
because
it?
Because I love a turn. I love it when somebody stops the world and they go, you thought I was just this, but I'm that, you know? And also, I can't remember the order of events, whether the Blind Side came after this or before.
Before, this is Blind Side's before this.
I know. So, okay, Sandy B really needed like another after the Blind Side, really needed another... you know, look at me, I'm Sandy B. Sandy,
I don't mind it.
Can't you see I'm in Gravity? Ba, 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 ba. I'm in space with little oxygen and baby Diego's dead.
She's just after The Blind Side, she's done The Heat.
Yep.
Which is funny as fuck.
That's funny.
She is
well, this is
funny.
My thing. But no, of course she's funny.
She's
that's what
funny
I'm saying.
In that. So then what she...
No, but never hurt. She was always funny. She was always funny. That's my point. That what she was before was funny. Everyone said about Sandy B. They said, Sandy B? What, Sandy B? Yeah, great actress. Beautiful. That's the first thing they said because everyone's a horrible misogynist. They were like, beautiful. Funny.
Beautiful.
She's funny, that girl. She's funny. She's got comedy chops. You know, she makes me laugh. She makes my wife laugh. That's what they all said. Because, again, it was a different time. But what we hadn't really seen from Sandy B was the showstopper. We hadn't seen someone be, like, you know, yeah, she's still the girl next door. She's just in a spaceship next door, but she's full of pathos, man. You know, it's like she's got it in this role, and we hadn't necessarily seen that before. So I love a turn, love a turn.
I don't love a turn.
Yeah, you
I
hate mean, a turn.
All these comedy people.
Because you want to know about it 18 months before it happens so that you can tell everyone else that you already knew. That's why you hate a turn.
No, I just want you to keep the pathos away from me. I think comedy is the harder thing. And that's what people like her and Jim Carrey forgot. You've already ascended. And it's because the Oscars don't reward that with a Best Actor nominee,
yeah, yeah.
Anything comedic.
Yeah.
And because it's seemingly all about ego,
sure,
they forget themselves.
Right.
She's already transcended everyone with her performances in Miss Congeniality. Lovely turn in Speed.
Yeah.
She can do action comedy.
Yeah.
Heat. And then she's like, no, I want to have a dead kid in Gravity.
Sure.
You don't need to do it.
I know. I don't think she needed to do it. I think she wanted to do it, and that's fine. I think it's also a very, by the sounds of it, a complicated and technical shoot in terms of the procedural elements of it, which would have been interesting, a different kind of challenge for an actor who's maybe a bit more used to kind of sliding into the room and giving a wink, you know, which is, she's very good at doing that.
She was so accommodating on the set. She sounds lovely.
Right. She, hard worker.
She was in the rig for fucking hours.
Mm.
And do you know what? You know when someone's a good egg? I've got to go back to good eggs.
Yeah.
You can tell she's a good egg. Clooney, good egg. Huh?
Has that fan gone on again?
George Clooney, good egg.
Good egg.
Good egg.
Eggs.
The good egg. We do have a hard out today, very rarely. I'm in my kid's room. They're having bath. He's going to go to bed soon.
Yeah.
And I have to be out of here.
Okay.
So we have a hard out.
My hard out's not for 3 hours and 40 minutes.
Oh, I thought you had a hard out.
At 10.
Oh, hard out at 10?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
But it sounds like your hard out is a lot more pressing.
It's more like if I'll open the door and then go into the living room and pretend that I have to carry on doing this.
Right. And then right now?
My wife can...
How much longer have you got before your first sort of soft out?
Let's aim for 7, but it'd be great if we... let's aim for 7.
Yeah, fine, we can do that. We've got loads of time. Good eggs.
Good eggs.
I love talking about Harry Potter, by the way. Let's find more films where we can get, like, a Harry Potter adjacent connection so I can do some more Potter stuff.
The beauty of that is I love finding a little needle.
In
and
Potter?
Then find, yeah, and then you rise up like a nun shall pass.
Sure, yeah.
And you nun shall pass it.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm all ears.
Well, listen, the way I look at that is that you're a Horcrux and I'm Harry Potter and, you know, you might think he'll never find me. But despite not having any information about where to find you and not really any help from any older people, I find you anyway. And
yes.
I was going to say I queef you. That's not right. I bequeath you. No, I eviscerate, I suppose. I annihilate. I eradicate, you know. I stop you. I say I find you and you were. And then when I found you, you weren't after. You're not now. You know what I'm saying? You were, but now you're not. That's what I like.
Well, you say that, but you don't. That makes me not want to do it.
Oh.
I don't think you make me not. It's more like I just imagine you.
Right.
There's that bit in Half Blood Prince.
Oh yeah, come on.
That I had to read to my daughter.
What
recently.
Is it? Tell me what it is.
There's a big thing held of goo.
A puddle? A goo puddle?
It's this disgusting goo, and Dumbledore has to keep drinking down this disgusting filth.
Yeah, they make it very watery in the film. Is it thick in the book? I can't remember the books. Is it
so
thick?
It feels so thick. Oh. It's to be fair to Rowling, it's really well written. It's harrowing. And then later on, all these zombies crawl out of the lake. And I thought, is this damaging to read to my child?
Right.
But so what I'm saying is what I'm doing, I'm the goo.
Yeah.
And I make all my thoughts about Potter are, and I make you drink them down and you have to keep drinking them down and you're drinking and you're downing them.
But I get to be Dumbledore.
Yeah, you're Dumbledore.
I'll do it. I'll have the part.
And then ultimately, you're so weakened, I later come in and I shiv you and you die.
You're Malfoy and Snape.
Of course I am.
Well, Snape's the great hero of Harry Potter, isn't he? That's the thing. Oh, that's why Harry middle names one of his children as Severus. This is why you're called Albus Severus, Ronald, Hermione, Bill. I don't know why I've said Bill. Neville, something, another name, Potter. You know, this is why you've got all the names of every character that's been a good character. Can I say?
Well, of course, lest we forget to... Professor Snape is really the richest hero of the Potter mythology, and we must not forget that, as too often we forget. Professor Snape, he is the hero of the series. Let us go back. Let us read the subtext of all the lines of all the things.
No,
that he
listen,
didn't
it's not
say,
in the subtext. But, listen, listen. That's one other thing they nail in those films. Is Alan Rickman's final scenes as Severus Snape?
Look,
you know,
listen,
where he cries
I'm gonna need another can
into the vial.
If you're going to carry on, I'm going to have to go to three cans.
He drips
I made
a
pledge
tear
to you.
Into the.
I
into
said,
the,
yeah, yeah, I said on. Two cans, yeah, no more than two.
Well, you did have a
and
two
if you're
going to,
if you're going to, if you're, listen, I was doing a two can pledge.
It was a two can pledge.
And now, if you're going to do this, I'm going to need a third can. What can we? What should we dig into now? Should we just should we wrap up with
we
the box?
We haven't finished Bullock yet.
Oh, okay.
I want to Bullock. I just want a little bit more from Bullock. And now I listen. I know you've kindly mentioned Miss Congeniality already. I just want to say once again what a delight that film is. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is what I wanted to do. I want you to explain Bullock to me without just telling me you like those movies.
Oh.
Don't just tell me Miss Congeniality is great fun.
Right.
Don't just say, I really like The Proposal.
Yeah.
Sell me Bullock.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in Bullock. She's funny.
Yeah.
But come on, mate, step up.
Well, I was reading a little bit about Bullock earlier just to prepare myself to discuss Bullock. And something interesting I found. She was in the first TV movie she was cast in, because she had a long old route to the top. You know, she worked in New York she was.
She's old.
That's not what I meant. But she worked in New York for a while. You know, she did some plays, whatever. Did some TV movies. She did some. I think she did the first like proper role was the TV series adaptation of Working Girl. Was it Working Girl? I think it was Working Girl.
What?
Let me check.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it was Working Girl. It was cancelled. It was only 12 episodes of it. It was cancelled and it was kind of, you know, it wasn't considered a success. Right, in 1990. Anyway, then she was cast in a TV film and the director of the time said she was perfect for it because she was basically, you know, she was the girl next door. She was like Julia Roberts, but she was really cheap because no one knew who she was. And that's where, you know, then eventually you find that she gets a role in Demolition Man.
She's so good in that film.
Right, right. But
have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen Demolition Man, no.
If you're a Sandra Bullock fan and you want to see her arc, you've got to watch Demolition Man. She's so fun in that. She makes it so watchable.
Right.
Sly Stallone...
He got her the part, by the way, because he'd seen her in something else and he thought she was great. So apparently she got the role because of him.
Fair play to Sly. He knows talent.
Yeah.
They're going places.
That's right. And then she does go somewhere because the next year she's in Speed with Keanu Reeves. And the thing that is said about her in Speed, the reason that she impressed so much in the film is because obviously that is it's a ridiculous film.
it's not.
It's fun. No, but I mean the premise is ridiculous. I don't mean it's not. It's a great film, but the premise of the film is ridiculous. And there's so much high octane it's in terms of the pacing in that film. That's a hard thing to manage in terms of performance because the plot of the movie, of course, as you'll remember, or for anyone that hasn't seen, is she's on a bus with Keanu Reeves, and if the bus goes beneath a certain speed on the speedometer, the bus will explode. So they have to keep going above a certain speed, and you can imagine, in the traffic of LA, is that where they are in LA? I think it is, isn't it? And, you know, with all the obstacles and stuff, crazy things happen. So it's a high intensity movie, And it, you know, in terms of, you know, from a performance perspective, it would be difficult to, you know, keep that up all the way through. She grounds it. And
she grounds it. The thing specifically, it's a very grounded movie.
No, great point. And the thing that impressed people specifically about her performance in that was the chemistry that she developed with Keanu. And Keanu, I love Keanu, but he's not the easiest person to have chemistry with, because sometimes he can be a little wooden, or he can appear a little wooden. And Bullock, as the counterpoint to Keanu, oh, mwah, beautiful in that film, you know? She's got chops. That's where we see the chops.
Can I throw a phrase at you?
Yes.
This is going to derail us for 20 minutes.
Oh, please do.
Girl Next Door.
Yes. Alicia Cuthbert. Is that what
not
you,
the movie.
Yeah, not the film. Okay, fine. Emile Hirsch and Alicia Cuthbert.
Put your willy away.
Okay.
From and thoughts away. I'm talking about the trope or the idea of the actress that is the girl next door type. You know, you've got Kirsten Dunst, mm-hmm. you've got your Sandra Bullocks.
Yeah.
And why culture used to, I don't know if the girl next door is a thing anymore.
I don't think it is
certainly,
anymore, no.
Okay, well, why am I talking about
no,
it?
No, 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 I think that's, yeah, I think that's why, it's
that's
really
why
interesting.
Sandra Bullock is massive.
It's really interesting.
Or got massive, right?
I agree. This is my take on the girl next door, not the Alicia Cuthbert, Emil Hirsch film, on the girl next door trope, yeah? And I do want to give a content warning here, because I'm going to use some words and I'm going to use some descriptive phrases that are very offensive to women in my experience. Okay. Guess what the girl next door isn't, because she's easier to define by what she isn't. A whore. That's what
me.
She isn't. Okay. And again, this is, I don't support this. What I'm saying is this is if Hollywood movie executives and audiences were being honest in the 90s and the 80s, this is what they meant, okay?
I'd love to dig into why the girl next door is no longer a thing. There's probably a more disgusting trope that women have to suffer
yeah.
as a result.
There is.
It looks like someone's gonna wanna put my son to bed.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
We can do a bit more reading. We can read our stories for a while there.
I can go in there.
Okay, yeah.
So I go in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, we're gonna count.
It smells like a pub in here. Oh,
Christ.
It smells like a pub in the room. Like... That is bad.
Three cans. I'm on my third. I've had two cans.
You've broken. You
Joe
broke
keeps,
the third
keeps,
three can
Joe
convention.
Talking about.
We've been in here for like an hour. You've had three.
But
cans.
Joe keeps talking. He won't stop talking.
Glenn is gonna be sleeping with fumes of alcohol.
Oh my god.
Male aggression.
Yeah. Anyway, so.
Yeah.
I don't have any more. These are my three cans for the day. My.
The more the lady doth protest. Should we play the box office game?
yeah, you know, I think that would be good.
That's for the best, is it?
I think that's for the best. I need to do a announcement.
You need to do an announcement?
Well, like, I did see a number.
Oh. What number did you see?
Just a budget number.
The fun one is gross worldwide anyway, so I think that's okay.
I'll tell you what, I'll be honest, if I was going to be what I thought the budget of this would be before knowing the number, and then I'll say what I think the budget is.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's start there then. The brackets estimated budget for the film Gravity. What did you think it was before what the number you saw said?
I mean, you're looking at this film and you're saying 100
yep.
million.
Yes.
But then I saw the number 80, and then I moved on. So I think it's 80.
That's interesting, because the number I have here is 100. The number that is coming from IMDb Pro is $100 million, estimated at least. So maybe you saw 80, and that's actually what they spent, or maybe that's another estimation from somebody else, and the official information hasn't been released. But either way, I think I can call that a plum success.
Well, no, because I saw the number, so it's not.
But you were thinking 100. And then the number you saw was different to that.
There's no... I'm not having any of that.
You won't take a victory lap?
No.
No. Okay, fine. Well, let's see if we can get you a victory lap, or indeed an embarrassing mishap, on opening weekend US and Canada. Now, let me tell you, this is an Oct 6th release, 2013. So Christmas is in sight, but we're not there yet. What do you think?
It's space. It's getting space. Great reviews. It's yeah. Sandra Bullock. It's George Clooney.
Sandy B. George C.
The vibe is up on it straight away. Yep. So yep. it's yep. going to yep. get yep. bums on seats. And how many bums?
That's the question.
Logan bums?
Well.
Jumper bums?
Logan was 75, I think. Jumper was 35.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... You say that, I was like... I didn't know that. I was like, they were like feelings and like colours, and then you've put right. numbers on those colours. Right, and now right. then it feels like when I say a number, it's going to be less impressive.
Right. Okay. Well, I think the audience would have assumed that you remembered, but...
I don't.
Know.
I'm
right.
And when I say I talk in film and colour, and then you talk in this like totalitarian
numbers, that was 35, that was 70,
it just takes the magic out of the game.
Herr Gruber, we tried the system. It worked. The maths is accurate, Herr Gruber. Who's Herr Gruber? Oh, he's from The Lives of Others, isn't he?
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Herr Gruber.
Herr Gruber, I've assimilated the data. I heard the opening weekend US and Canada for Logan and that other movie. That, you know, it's funny that, isn't it? I can't remember the name of the films or the film, but I can remember how much the opening weekend was.
What a bucket you have.
Very strange bucket. Now, come on, give me a number or a colour.
Oh, the colour is $40 million.
Well, that, tell you what, colour me pink. Is that what the word is? Colour me orange. What do they say? Colour me surprised, is it?
Colour me stupid.
Colour me stupid. You're wrong. It's 55, nearly $56 million. I mean, that's a huge success opening weekend, $56 million. People wanted to see the film. You gave it the wrong colour.
I said 4, and yeah. the number's 5.5. I'm so yeah. close.
You said 40.
No. You see, this is why we speak different languages.
Right.
You're thinking in tens and millions.
Well, yeah, that's the game.
You've said 5.5 effectively, and I've said
uh-huh.
4.
Uh-huh.
And I'm so close.
Well, this is why I love the 10% rule, you see, because the 10% rule applies regardless of how big and how many digits the number has. And if we want to apply the 10% rule to both of those, your 40 million guess, you're still out, and your 4, you're still out, unfortunately. So that's what we like to
this
call...
This is a rule that one
that's
of
what
your,
Herr Gruber calls a victory.
It's one of your best friends has called this rule arbitrary, fascistic nonsense.
Right. Sorry, English Ricky's talked about this rule.
Fine. I'm happy with how close I was at 40.
Yeah. No, well done. I think that's good. I'm impressed too. And you refused to take any goodwill for thinking right about the budget, even though you'd seen the number. Now, gross worldwide. Here's an interesting one for you. Gross worldwide for the film Gravity. We know it did well at the awards as well, don't we? So... what does that mean? Presumably, largo.
Well, let's do Joe's special maths game. Times 10, times 10 plus 10, or whatever the fuck.
Sure. Yeah. Now, let me remind you, though. Let me remind you before you
no,
do
no,
that.
No. I know the number you said. You've made 55.
It's the 10x game.
I'm not doing
right?
10x on my guess. I'm doing 10x on the facts.
I know. 10x, to the 10x game, though, is really a guide. It's more like, do you know what XG is in football term?
Yes, I do. Well, no, I don't actually. So, just but don't answer me then. Don't tell me.
I won't
what
explain
it,
but my point is, XG is a guide for what would be expected based on the chances created. It's not what the results were. So, the 10x guide is a nice guide, but I think over time, the fun in this bit of the game is going to be: does this overperform? Does this underperform?
This is 10x? This is where your stats become interesting.
That's where we find the detail, because of course you could have an incredible striker who was expected to score 7 goals in the season, but he scored 10 because he's really good.
Lives of Others times 35.
There you go. I mean, 2 million massively outperformed, right? That's like a generation anomaly. generational
anomaly.
Who
do you equate Lies of Others as a football player?
Who wasn't expected to do well at all, but did really, really, really well.
Or how about this? Let's take it away from football.
Yeah.
Band. Book.
Band. Which band?
Which band is the Lives of Others? Which football
Ed Sheeran.
Hey!
Because you look at Ed Sheeran and you're like, yeah, sure, this guy's a good songwriter, good musician, but like ultimately he is a kind of annoying guy with an acoustic guitar who seems to want it a bit too much. You know, that's what. So like he could go quite far. He could go quite far, but he could be Mumford and Sons, but he can't be like Whitney Houston because it's just Ed Sheeran. Wow, Ed Sheeran is the Lives of Others. Of band world. He massively overperformed your expectations, didn't he? I mean, he's like the most famous guy in the world. Taylor Swift performed to expectations. That's what you would expect for when you look at Taylor Swift and listen to Taylor Swift's music.
Not,
it's like,
well, not over the timeline, mate. Not over the timeline. Not, yeah, depends where you look at the timeline. Don't expect, say that, mate. They'll get on you. They will tear you to shreds, mate. Take it back. Take it back.
But I think Ed Sheeran has overperformed his XG for sure. And well done to him. Well done to him.
So on the maths, 55. So we're talking in the realms of 550, 600. Did it overperform?
Well,
it got Oscars.
Yeah. I don't like how you do that, I have to say. The 10x rule is just is as it is. It's 10x. It's not the 10.5x rule, you know? So when you say $55 to $60 million, that's not what the 10x rule says. $560 million. That's what it is.
Yeah. So okay. Anyway, it's in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
Let's say it did overperform. I'm going to say because it won Oscars. There was a little backlash at the time, and it has totally been forgotten by culture.
Right.
But I reckon.
But how much did it overperform?
Not hugely. I reckon it made $750 million.
Oh man, that is music to my. That, do you know what? I'm so proud of you.
Oh,
can you hear that?
I can hear the cat meowing because he's locked out of the room. He's like, "What do you tell me?" And then I let him out. This episode has been an absolute shit show. Fucking
no,
domestic disaster.
$773 million. Oh. You're well within the 10% rule. Well done. Round of applause from me. That's very impressive. Okay, you can sort the cat if you want.
Joe, should
yes?
we do the bit of the game where one of us tries to catch out the other one from with a movie, not from a movie, with a movie or film that they forgot? They forgot. I got you last week on Gravity. I smashed you with five female protagonist movies because I love women in cinema. No pressure. Let's reset the agenda.
Yeah.
Hit me with your films. Let's see.
With my films that have all got men in.
Oh, weird that, isn't it? Let's see what the theme of Joe's films are. Have they all got films in? Are they all about ejaculating teenagers? Oh, yeah, I think they will be. Hit me.
Of my films all got films in.
Shit, sorry. Oh.
Okay, I'm going to hit you hard. I'm going to hit you right hard. I'm going to plumb with a bee, right? I'm plumbing with a bee right into your septicon, okay? Are you ready? Are you ready to receive me? Are you opening?
Yeah, I've got the bat up. I'm waiting.
Wide open?
Yep.
Here we go. Missing the bat. It is the Darjeeling Limited.
Yeesh.
Wes Anderson has never been more forgetting. Forgotten. Forgetting.
Oh, Rushkadu. Ah.
Rushkadu? I think that means yes. I think I'm hearing the sound of a bee plum.
This is not plum.
Well, it could never really be plum because it's Wes Anderson, but it's the most plum Wes, isn't it?
Fuck it, man. Have Golden Duck me. No, Golden Duck. Do you want a Golden Duck me?
What's Golden Duck?
Oh, it's another. Let's just. Well, I can explain it, but it's a cricket thing.
Oh, right. I don't know cricket. Darjeeling Limited is good, right? That's good.
You've golden ducked me.
What does that mean?
Do you know what? I could tell you what a golden duck is. Golden duck is you've come in as a batsman,
right?
And you're out first ball. Okay, it's not just plum. I'm not my pad isn't in front of the ball. It's not an LBW call. You've passed the pad and you've blasted the wicket. and I'm golden ducked. I'm out. I'm going back to the pavilion. I'm going back to the pavilion. No runs.
Yeah, the Darjeeling Limited. No runs. And you're going to have to prepare, though, because I don't mean for the episode, I mean for me, because I hate Wes Anderson. And in fact, I think Wes Anderson's made a number of very, very good films. But I hate what Wes Anderson stands for, and I hate most of Wes Anderson's films, with the kind of fury that you might not have heard from me before, because I'm normally such a nice guy, you know?
But there's going to be a little delay. This episode isn't going to come out for 2 weeks, because you've got things you need to attend to.
Let me tell you, though, as a little throw-in.
Bum-wise.
Did you say bum-wise?
Yeah, bum-wise. You've got some stuff to attend to bum-wise.
With my bum?
Can I say that? Is that fun?
Do you know what I'm getting attended? I feel like you actually don't know now.
No, I do, but it's funny if I say bum-wise.
Right, okay, yeah. I've got stuff to attend to bum-wise, yeah.
So even though we've only just got back into the thrust of things,
we've only just got back into the bum of things.
There's going to be a little break because Joe does seriously have a serious medical condition he needs attending to.
I'm not joking.
So it just means do hold on. We're coming right back.
Yeah.
Apologies for the delay.
Well, let me throw in a little treat as well, yeah? Just for you. I've got some time when I'm recovering from my bum. So I will... it's not my bum. So I'll also watch The Grand Budapest Hotel again, because I think that's a great film. And I don't want to come totally negative on Anderson. So I'll watch that as well as The Darjeeling Limited, so that I'm throwing some positive vibes in there as well.
I think you're going to be positively surprised by The Darjeeling Limited.
Hmm.
I think it's a perfectly lovely film. Owen Wilson's lovely
Owen
in it.
Owen Wilson.
Adrian Brody is lovely in it. And Schwartzman is lovely in it. Those are my recollections. I reckon you're going to come out top on it, and I'm going to go, well, no, I didn't really like it.
Well, that is what normally happens.
That was the Gravity episode. Apologies for next week. There will be a little gap. But we have been doing very long episodes lately. And I've got to say goodbye now. Say bye. Can we say bye-bye?
Minnie just climbed up Rose's bunk.
Her bunk.
Goodbye.
Say bye.
And very important.
Yes, I know.
And very cool. And
yeah,
handsome.
Very stylish.
Say bye, Joe.
And cool.
Bye, Joe.
Bye, Joe.
I don't even know who you are.